TorahCafe.com.
Today, I'll be talking to you primarily about the case that my father, Nathan Lewin, and I brought 10 years ago, or more than 10 years ago, back in 2003, so it's 11 years ago now, which involves the right of an American citizen born in Jerusalem to have Israel listed as his or her place of birth on their U.S. passport. That case is now headed back to the United States Supreme Court for the second time and will be argued during the first week of November. If I ask you, where is the Kotel HaMaravi, where is the Western Wall or the Wailing Wall, everyone knows it's in Jerusalem. The Knesset's in Jerusalem. Hadassah Hospital's in Jerusalem. But if I ask you whether any of those places are in Israel, what will you tell me? You are likely to say, of course, Jerusalem is part of Israel. But it may surprise you to know that that's not the position of the United States government. The United States does not recognize Jerusalem as being in Israel. The result is that on American passports of citizens born in Jerusalem, the United States refuses to list Israel as the place of birth. The standard practice, the traditional rule for an American citizen born abroad is that their country of birth is what is listed on their U.S. passport. So my father, for example, was born in Lodz, Poland. His American passport says he was born in Poland. Just the country is listed. If you're born in Rome, your passport lists your place of birth as Italy. If you're born in Tel Aviv, or in Haifa, or in Beersheba, your passport lists your place of birth as Israel. The exception to that rule is if you happen to be born in Jerusalem. Even if you were born in West Jerusalem, which has been under Israel's control since its creation, because the United States does not recognize Jerusalem as being in Israel, they say that the future, the status of Jerusalem must be determined in future peace negotiations. The State Department lists the city, they list Jerusalem on the passport as the place of birth instead of the country, instead of Israel. What is more troubling about the State Department practice is that, say you are an Arab American citizen born in Jaffa, so your passport would list Israel as your place of birth. Well, what if you're offended or horrified at the notion that your passport lists your place of birth as Israel? The State Department is ready to accommodate that, and if you request it, they will take Israel off your passport, and they will put Jaffa, the town you were born in, or if you were born before 1948, and you request it, they'll list your place of birth as Palestine on your passport. If you're born in the Gaza Strip or in the West Bank, you can request that Gaza Strip or West Bank be listed as your place of birth. So they will take Israel off the passport if you so desire. But if you're an American citizen born in Jerusalem and you want to have Israel listed as your place of birth on your passport, the State Department will not allow it. So in 2002, Congress decided to rectify this inequity, and they passed a law. And the law said that if an American citizen, or the guardian, requests it, then an American citizen born in Jerusalem, then the State Department shall list Israel as the place of birth on the U.S. passport of those American citizens born in Jerusalem who ask for it. That means that the default would be they would still list Jerusalem, but if you wanted to say Israel, the State Department would acquiesce. It had to, according to this law, acquiesce and list Israel as your place of birth. Well, when the law was passed, President Bush, this is the second, the junior, signed the bill into law. He didn't veto the law, but he issued what they called a signing statement at the same time. And he said, I'm not vetoing this law, but we're not going to interpret this as mandatory, despite the fact that the language said shall, which is about as mandatory as you can get. He says, we're going to view this as just advisory. Because, he says, we're not going to follow the law, because I, the president, believe that Congress went too far, and that Congress exceeded its authority when they passed this law, because they've impermissibly interfered with the executive branch's exclusive authority to recognize foreign sovereigns. 3 weeks after the law was passed, a very good friend of mine, childhood friend of mine, who had made Aliyah, gave birth to her third child in Jerusalem. This was the first one of their children born in Israel. And I told her about the law when I called her to wish her a Mazel Tov, and suggested that maybe when she goes to get her child's passport, she might be interested in requesting that it say Israel. She did that. And the folks at the embassy in Israel told her it made no difference what the law said. Her passport, her child's passport, was still going to say Jerusalem, not Israel, as the place of birth. And sure enough, when it came back, it said Jerusalem. And that's how Menachem Binyamin Zivotofsky became our law firm's youngest pro bono client. When he was less than a year old, we filed a lawsuit. Then it was Zivotofsky versus Powell. Over the years, it's become Zivotofsky versus Clinton, and now it's known as Zivotofsky versus Kerry. As I said, it's worked its way up and down in the courts, and we're now headed back to the U.S. Supreme Court for the second time. I'll tell you a little bit about the history of the case. When we first brought the case in the district court, it's the lowest court in D.C., the federal court, the judge there really wanted to have nothing whatsoever to do with this case. She never called us in for a hearing. We never appeared before her. She decided this case purely on the papers, and she threw it out. This is at the very, very beginning. The government filed a motion to dismiss, and she threw it out for lack of standing. We appealed to the Court of Appeals, to the D.C. Circuit, and they reversed. They held that we did have standing. We went back down again to the D.C. Circuit. Once again, the judge wanted nothing to do with it, and she threw the case out as a political question grounds. Political question, for those who may not be familiar, or if there's some non-lawyers in the audience, is there's a principle that the courts are not supposed to be making determinations that are essentially foreign policy determinations that really are reserved for other branches of government. And here, the argument that the government made was that by putting Israel as the place of birth on the passport, we were asking the court to make this kind of foreign policy decision, to make this judgment, and therefore the court couldn't even touch this case, they argued, and it should be thrown out as a political question. We said that's not our situation. Our situation here is if there was a political decision that was made or a foreign policy decision that was made by Congress when they passed this law. And what we are asking the court to do is to decide whether or not Congress, when it passed the law, had the authority to do that. Either this law is constitutional, because Congress had the authority to pass the law, and it must be followed, or the court could decide that the law is unconstitutional and strike it down. But deciding the constitutionality of a statute is what courts do all the time. And the court can't just shirk its responsibility in this case because the subject matter of the statute may touch upon a sensitive issue. So we went up again to the D.C. Circuit and presented this argument. The D.C. Circuit ruled against us, but Judge Edwards did issue a dissent where he said that this case is clearly not a political question. However, he said it's clear on the merits, and we'll get to this, the separation of powers question, that our side would lose, that he felt that it was an exclusive executive branch power, this recognition power, and therefore there was no harm done, essentially. Now, what is this separation of powers question? The argument, the Solicitor General, the State Department's argument, is that by putting Israel on the passport of an American citizen born in Jerusalem, That is tantamount to the United States recognizing Israel's sovereignty over Jerusalem. And they argue that the authority to recognize foreign sovereigns is a power, that recognition power, belongs exclusively to the executive branch. Well, what was interesting is when we went up to the Supreme Court, we filed a cert petition on the narrow political question issue. We decided we don't have to get yet to this separation of powers question. Let's just have the court resolve, we thought, or I thought optimistically in our favor, the political question issue, and we can continue the case, we'll stay alive, and we can continue to argue it. Well, the Supreme Court did something very unusual. They granted our cert petition on the political question, but then, sua sponte, on their own, they issued a directive instructing us that in addition to briefing and arguing the political question issue, they wanted us to actually brief and argue before the Supreme Court the merits of the case. Specifically, when Congress passed this law, did it impermissibly interfere with this exclusive authority of the president to recognize foreign sovereigns? So we were in the very unusual position, after this case had been back and forth in the courts for 9.5, 10 years, we were now being asked for the first time to argue the merits of the case before the Supreme Court of the United States. So we had to go back and do some research. Well, we were very pleased to discover that if you go back and you look, the whole notion of this recognition power is not such a simple question. It's not so clear-cut the way Judge Edwards seemed to think it was. Rather, there are those, first of all, who suggest that there is no such thing as a recognition power. There's nothing in the Constitution that talks about the right or the power to recognize foreign sovereigns. The hook that the government hangs its hat on is the clause that gives the president the right to receive foreign ambassadors. They claim that that's what gives the executive branch the right to recognize foreign sovereigns. But there are those scholars and historians who say that that was never meant to be a grant of some major foreign policy power. To the contrary, it was meant to be exactly what it said, a ceremonial responsibility. The ambassadors from the foreign countries would come and they would present their credentials to the president. It was never meant to mean or to delegate to the president anything more than that. Scholars and historians, in particular, a professor named Robert Reinstein, who devoted quite a bit of time, it turned out, fortunately for us, to studying the recognition power in history, showed and demonstrated, though, that historically, when it did come to recognizing foreign sovereigns, that power was never viewed, at least by the original founding fathers and from presidents George Washington through Lincoln, never viewed as an exclusive power of the executive branch. To the contrary, it was viewed as a shared power between Congress and the president. And over and over and over again, throughout our country's early history, the presidents would regularly turn to Congress when it came to recognizing foreign sovereigns. The presidents did not believe that they had the authority alone to recognize foreign sovereigns. So, for example, President Lincoln, when he came to power, when he became president, his first address to Congress urged Congress to recognize the countries of Haiti and Liberia. These were two black countries that the United States had up until then refused to recognize. President Lincoln clearly did not think that he could just become president and recognize these countries on his own. He felt he needed Congress first to recognize these countries, and that is indeed what happened. The Republic of Texas was an independent republic for about 10 years before it became part of the United States. President Jackson, when it came to recognizing the Republic of Texas, first Congress recognized the independent Republic of Texas, and then President Jackson, on his last day in office, acquiesced to that recognition. We filled our brief the last time around in the Supreme Court, and now again this time around, with numerous examples of this type of history showing the court that it is not at all clear that there is such a thing as an exclusive executive branch recognition power. If anything, it's a shared power. And we argued that under the steel seizure case in the Supreme Court, if you have a situation involving foreign policy where Congress has spoken first, then the president's power is, as the Supreme Court said there, at its lowest ebb. And you have to scrutinize carefully the president's desired actions in light of what Congress has said. We said, here you have an example of that situation where Congress spoke on this issue, and the president does not have the authority to just contradict what Congress has said. In fact, we argue that in this situation where there's a conflict, Congress wins, and the president has to act within the parameters that Congress set. We made all of these arguments in addition to the political question arguments before the Supreme Court back in 2012. What was interesting is that then the court ruled 8-1 in our favor on the political question issue and said, you're right, the court must decide this case and has to decide whether or not the statute is constitutional. But then the court said, just because we say that the court has to decide doesn't mean it's simple to decide it. And they decided that what they preferred is to first have the benefit of the lower courts grappling with the merits of the case before they have to deal with it. So they sent the case back down on the merits, and we went back this time, not all the way down to the district court, but only to the D.C. Circuit. The case was argued before the D.C. Circuit in March of 2013, and the Court of Appeals, sadly, ruled against us again. This time, they decided that they did... I wouldn't say they did away fully, but they treated very lightly the history that we had presented and still felt that this policy was running up against what they believed really should be an executive branch prerogative and authority. So we find ourselves now back again before the Supreme Court. It was interesting because there are a couple of new arguments that we've been able to make. One argument that has now arisen is there's the section of the statute that we deal with is the fourth section of a longer law that deals actually with moving the embassy to Jerusalem, the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem. And our case deals only with the passport legislation, but the government has tried to make an argument out of the fact that it is part of this larger law and suggests that Congress may have never really intended this to be what we call passport legislation because it really is part of this larger legislation. After the Obamacare decision by the Supreme Court, where the court decided that it must try to uphold congressional statutes even if the reasoning may differ from what Congress set out as its reasoning. If you remember, Congress had insisted that Obamacare was not a tax, and yet the Supreme Court upheld it as under the right of Congress to impose a tax. We say here, even if the rationale may be a little bit different from what Congress may have intended, the Supreme Court can still determine that this is passport legislation. And let me explain this alternative argument, because as I said, we have made the argument that historically, if you're going to decide this as a separation of powers recognition case, then it is a shared power between Congress and the President. We've given the Supreme Court an easy way out, and that is to say that what you put on a passport does not amount to formal recognition of sovereignty. As we saw, and as I said, there are all sorts of things that we put on a passport as a place of birth. The United States agrees to put Gaza Strip, West Bank, Palestine, none of these are recognized foreign sovereigns. And in fact, in 1994, Congress passed a law that said that those individuals born in Taiwan may list Taiwan as their place of birth on their U.S. passport. And this caused some friction with China because the United States does not recognize Taiwan's sovereignty. We recognize Taiwan, we recognize China as being sovereign over the area of Taiwan. In fact, the Chinese at first refused to grant visas to individuals whose passports listed Taiwan as their place of birth in their passport. So the United States, the State Department, came out and made a big declaration, put it in the Foreign Affairs Manual, saying, we're allowing individuals to put Taiwan as their place of birth, but this does not change the United States' position on Taiwan's sovereignty. We still recognize China as sovereign over the area of Taiwan. So there, that also demonstrates that what you put on a passport does not equal, it's not tantamount to formal recognition. So we have said to the Supreme Court, if the court does not wish to reach this major separation of powers question, they can decide that this really is just passport legislation. And Congress has historically passed statutes regarding passports. They can determine what goes on a passport, how long a passport is valid. All of these fall within Congress's authority. And so this is just another example of Congress exercising its right to enact passport legislation. What's interesting is we just filed our brief in the Supreme Court July 15th. July 22nd, there were numerous amicus or friend of the court briefs filed. There was one brief filed on behalf of the entire United States Senate, all 100 senators, and that brief made exactly this argument. It said that this is passport legislation, does not amount to formal recognition, and Congress clearly has the right to enact passport legislation. In a footnote, the Senate said that we don't think the court should reach the separation of powers question, but you should know that ours, the Senate's position, agrees with petitioner that this is a shared power, but that's not the argument that they were pushing the court to adopt. So there is this alternative, narrower ground. As I said, we filed our briefs now in July. We don't have a specific date yet for oral argument, but it's likely to be the first week in November. And our client in October is only turned 12. And as my father and I like to say, we hope that by the time he's bar mitzvahed, he'll be able to list Israel as a place for his U.S. passport.